Arsenal for Democracy is available twice a week. There's a free episode at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple or Stitcher each weekend, and a midweek bonus episode at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy, available for $5 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stunt Bird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, New York Island, the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 376, recorded on May 23rd, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
And joining me on the line from New York City is Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Rachel.
So, cane sugar is an ancient food product from Southeast Asia. By the late 1400s, before Columbus's expedition, it had become a popular but expensive luxury good in Europe, with cultivation starting up in the Atlantic islands belonging to Spain and Portugal, and obviously importation happening from places like India and Egypt and so forth. Columbus immediately expanded this into the Caribbean after his first voyage there, and both the Spanish and Portuguese made sugar one of the centerpieces of their colonial policies. The French and English followed suit with their own colonial activities in the Caribbean and North America, as well as in India and Southeast Asia, where it had originated. Control of lucrative sugar production, and also its refining, became one of the major motivating forces in foreign policy and colonial policy for several centuries, from the European wars for control of Caribbean sugar hubs to the American imperialist policies for control of Cuban, Puerto Rican, and Hawaiian sugar plantations in the late 19th century. Raw sugar production in the modern age was generally closely associated with some of the most brutal slavery in the world. By the time of the Industrial Revolution, European consumers of all classes had come to expect cheap, plentiful sugar that was no longer a luxury. Americans did too, and due to the mercantilist policies that resulted in the triangle trade, they had found themselves, after independence, as a major hub of sugar refining. The process of turning raw cane sugar into higher value trade goods and consumer goods, like table sugar, molasses, and rum. While liberal economics gradually rolled back government interventions, interferences, subsidies, tariffs, and state monopolies in many trade goods during the 19th century, sugar remained, and does to present day, a heavily protected industry. The U.S. government was also slow to act, as was true in several other industries as well, to prevent a tendency in the Second Industrial Revolution for the sugar industry to consolidate toward a near monopoly. By 1887, almost the entire production of refined sugar in the United States was controlled by a single sugar trust, the Sugar Refineries Company, later known as the American Sugar Refinery Company. That's the subject of today's episode. We're going to talk about the formation and breakup of the sugar trust in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, some of the personalities behind the sugar trust, some of the political impacts of the sugar industry on various countries, and some of the material processes and industrial history of this particular commodity. Let's talk first about the rise to power and initial failed antitrust litigation of and against the Sugar Trust. So the rise to power of the American Sugar Refinery Company, which occurred from 1887 onward and then culminated in the interventions of World War I by the U.S. government and then its subsequent breakup, we find some interesting academic articles that we can turn to from quite a while ago now. And one of the biggest sources that we used for this episode is the American Sugar Refinery Company, 1887 to 1914, The Story of a Monopoly by Richard Zerbe, published in October 1969 in the Journal of Law and Economics, Volume 12, Number 2. And we also looked at a follow-up article that he did, which will be available in our PDF of our notes at arsenalfordemocracy.com, and that article was basically following up on the initial paper, but also talking about a recent book that had been published around the same time, And this was an October 1970 article talking about both the earlier paper by Zerba and another academic's publication of a book, and basically disputing or agreeing with certain points in the history of this company. So Rachel and I took a look at this academic paper from 1969, which was quite long. Basically, the author tends to argue in his various papers, such as this one, that the sugar trust was not formed due to excessive competition and overproduction of refined sugar. That had been the prevailing view at the time and is still the view even today in some analyses. But rather, he argues that the trust formed due to the beneficial economies of scale of the larger operations and their ability to adopt new and more profitable technologies faster because of their ability to muster more investment capital faster. To rephrase that another way, this wasn't that there was so much production happening of refined sugar that the prices were at rock bottom and everyone was going to be destroyed unless they formed a cartel. Rather, it was that as certain companies became larger and larger, they had the ability to move faster to adapt to market conditions more effectively and more efficiently than some of their smaller competitors. And this was an extremely profitable industry. And of course, if you were a bigger company, you were making even more profits and so forth. And so it tended to have a snowball effect that became very useful for consolidation. By the time of the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, most of the mergers necessary to form this trust had already occurred. And that made it very difficult, as we'll talk about in a few minutes, for the government to step in at the end of this process or near the end of this process and block the expansions happening after. The other impediment, of course, was that they didn't actually really fully understand what was going on because, as was typical of a lot of these sort of corporate arrangements that we've talked about on the show, not all of these were fully transparent to the public or to the government as to what was happening, especially as we get this transition from intrastate commerce to interstate commerce and companies being organized only in one state versus being organized across state lines and so forth. So it took the federal regulators quite a while, even once they had the authority on paper to regulate interstate trusts and monopolies, to realize the full scale of what had happened with the formation of this trust. And Rachel, I'm going to turn to you now to explain and walk us through some of how this trust was formed by starting officially in 1887 and continuing beyond then.
Yeah, so H.O. Havemeyer, or Henry Osborne Havemeyer, was really kind of the sugar king. He had a really domineering personality. He had a big personality. And in accounts of the day, he seemed to not really use his manners when he was pursuing something that he wanted. So he was very domineering, kind of a bully, kind of a jerk. Kind of followed the pattern that we've talked about, starting with Standard Oil. He was kind of the Rockefeller of sugar. So during the 20 years prior to the formation of the trust, 1867 to 1887, the concentration of companies involved in sugar refining fell from 52 to 24. At this time, production of sugar was still rising. So those 24 companies were able to produce more and greater amounts of sugar compared to 20 years prior. At this time, there was also a tariff that made forming a trust a less risky proposition. Henry Havemeyer was quoted in an 1899 congressional hearing, "Without the tariff, I doubt if we should have dared to take the risk of forming the trust. It could have been done, but I certainly should not have risked all I had, which was embarked in the sugar business, in a trust, unless the business had been protected as it was by the tariff." So he did pursue a buyout scheme, going to smaller refineries and buying them out, but he really wasn't quite as aggressive as the Rockefellers. He rewarded people quite well for participating in mergers. One difference in the sugar industry versus the oil industry was that there was very little risk of competition against the refined product from abroad due to those import tariffs on the refined result. But raw cane sugar was being imported in many cases, except for Hawaii, depending on how you would define that relationship after 1875, which wasn't true for unrefined oil at the time. 1890 tariff revisions made raw sugar exempt from import tariffs, but the end of this exemption in 1898 boosted the sugar beet industry, which American Sugar Refinery Company also began buying up. Another difference from Standard Oil is that despite accusations that American Sugar Company was receiving favorable railroad shipping rates similar to Standard Oil, there was never much evidence uncovered that the railroads were giving American any special deals not available to others. So one of the very first buyouts that Havemeyer engaged in was when Klaus Spreckels, who was named the Sugar King of the Sandwich Islands, and he was kind of a West Coast sugar tycoon, he moved from the West Coast to build a refinery in Philadelphia. And at this time, Havemeyer was controlling a lot of the sugar refining on the East Coast. And so Havemeyer saw that as an obstacle to his success. And both Havemeyer personally and American Sugar bought out the refinery. And then after this, Spreckels became involved in the trust. And he basically ran West Coast operations for American-owned properties. So that kind of began his expansion and buyouts. The paper did describe people scamming the trust. They basically built new refineries that didn't actually work and then sold them to the trust so that it wouldn't act as competition, even though the refinery was not actually built in a way that it could be a competitor. There was one contractor that basically performed this multiple times. The paper spoke of a refinery that actually wasn't even close to like a water source, which is definitely needed for refining sugar. And it just wasn't plumbed in a way that it could bring in the water into the refinery to refine the sugar. Oftentimes Havemeyer was able to just wield the threat of price wars to buy out refiners, but he didn't often have to follow through. Just the threat was enough to secure a buyout in most cases. This is kind of a contrast to oil, in that those that didn't accept his offers weren't like basically driven out of business and ruined. And also stock buyouts happened at market prices. He didn't really undercut these refineries and buy their stock at pennies on the dollar. However, after Havemeyer's and Spreckels' deaths in 1907, the trust was weakened and competition kind of sprung up from there. Both Havemeyer and Spreckels were forces of nature, huge personalities, and after their deaths, their power was really diluted by boards of trustees. One of the properties that Havemeyer owned and ran, National Sugar, started acting in opposition to American Sugar once the strong personality of Havemeyer was no longer around to bully people. And this was further exacerbated by World War I. During World War I, wartime emergency regulations put the government in charge of prices and other aspects of the industry. These were repealed after the war, but relatively quickly followed up by the wrap-up of the antitrust litigation pending since 1910, which we'll discuss later, which resulted in the 1921-1922 breakup of American Sugar. A note for our listeners, there is an article linked in the show notes that follows up on this article that we discussed and argues against certain interpretations made in a book published around the same time called Monopoly, The Emergence of Oligopoly in the Case of Sugar Refining, which was also published in the Journal of Law and Economics in October 1970, Volume 13, Number 2. We're not discussing that in this episode, but we are linking to it in the show notes.
And just to pause here to emphasize a little bit, again, as you can tell with some of the folks like Spreckels, who was involved in sugar production in Hawaii, there was some relationship between sort of the folks involved in the sugar refining and the folks involved in the sugar production, but it wasn't quite to the same extent of vertical integration as we saw with Rockefeller and Standard Oil and so forth, which is another key distinction. So you can see the similar pattern on the refining side, which is obviously like the big part of Standard Oil's initial formation happened on the refining side. But we're focused less in this episode on the actual production of sugar. So as we said earlier, there was an attempt almost immediately after the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890 to try to say that this merger process that was happening to form this sugar trust was illegal under this new antitrust legislation. And there was an attempted federal lawsuit, which Kelly is about to talk about. But it was not very successful, which is why, as Rachel just talked about, it, the work of building this trust continued well after this initial lawsuit. But the gist of it is essentially that despite the almost total control of the sugar refining industry by one trust owning all these different subsidiary companies, the U.S. government was unable to make the case that this was, in fact, a monopoly in violation of the new antitrust legislation, which from our perspective today and with the information we have available to us today and even the information that was available within about 10 years of this through various federal investigations and so forth that continued in congressional investigations, it's obviously shocking what the outcome was from a factual standpoint, although certainly not politically shocking in any way. So Kelly, could you talk to us a little bit about the U.S. government's first attempt to break up the sugar monopoly?
Absolutely. So in 1894, shortly after the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, ASR had purchased four sugar refineries in Pennsylvania. They owned 98% of all refineries in the United States. They very clearly had, you know, a chokehold on the sugar refining industry. And so the federal government decided to take them to court to break up this monopoly. This is sort of a classic case of the federal government being outmatched in terms of the resources they had at their disposal. And one sort of interesting piece of information which foreshadowed this problem and the outcome of the event was that of the 22 defendants in the case, it did not include ASR's president. It included their treasurer, the folks from whom they were buying these sugar refineries, but it did not include ASR's president. They simply did not have the resources to go after the man at the top and did not have enough information. So they filed this suit trying to break up the monopoly. The federal government lost. Initially, the court of Eastern Pennsylvania said that this was because all four of the refineries were in Pennsylvania. All of this had happened in Pennsylvania, so it was not subject to interstate commerce laws because it was all happened within the boundaries of Pennsylvania. The federal government appealed this decision up to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court again sided with the Sugar Trust, this time picking apart some words in their interpretation of what the Sherman Antitrust Act applied to, saying that because this was about manufacturing and not about distribution, the Sherman Antitrust Act did not apply. And so this was an initial sort of heartbreak for antitrust folks who had hoped that this legislation would be the tool that the government needed to break up these trusts and these monopolies that had formed and were forming in the United States economy. So no dice here, lost twice, once because everything happened within the state boundaries of Pennsylvania, and once the Supreme Court ruled 8-1 against this, against the federal government here trying to break it up because of the nitpicking of the word manufacturing and distribution.
And it's an obvious absurdity as well, which is why I emphasize the distinction between what we would regard as a matter of facts versus what was the political reality here. I mean, you know, there's whether or not they were engaging in sort of unfair practices around price wars and competition of that nature. Certainly, the distribution across state lines of sugar is inherently going to be affected by the existence of a monopoly on the manufacturing refining process. Being consolidated into hands controlling 98% of it. Another thing is that, you know, while Rachel has talked about the process of acquiring all these different refinery businesses, you know, and the sort of importance of the individual personality of Havemeyer, one thing that also is a critical thing to understand here is similar to the consolidation of railroad systems in a previous era, which we've definitely alluded to on a lot of past episodes, but not really done a deep dive on, is that with the railroad systems, in many cases, especially to get around the sort of issues around state boundaries being really important in this period or before this period in terms of commerce, and that those boundaries could be pretty hard and fast, preventing corporations from engaging in activities officially across them. The railroad solution was that you would have one rich guy own a whole bunch of different railroads, right? And so he would own this railroad in this state, and he would own this railroad in the next state over, and he would put the railroads all the way up to the state line on either side, and then say, okay, now we're transferring from this railroad to this railroad, so technically it's not one company, it's actually two different companies. And we see that Havemeyer engaged in a similar practice in many ways, kind of hybridizing it with the Rockefeller approach of Standard Oil. And so we see that, you know, effectively at one point, at the point of this case, he had control of 98% of the refineries in the United States, for refining that raw sugarcane into those more manufactured goods that could be sold as consumer goods or inputs for other types of consumer good processes. A lot of that, in many cases, was not one company owning all the other companies. In many cases, it was one company owns X number of shares in another company that it wants to be a subsidiary. And then Havemeyer personally, as a rich guy stockholder himself, owns another amount of shares, Y amount of shares, and X plus Y happens to be a controlling interest in that company. But, you know, officially, on paper, you could make the case that, oh, it's fine, there's no monopoly here because, you know, he's obscured it through this various ownership mechanisms. And again, as Kelly said, there were 22 defendants in the E.C. Knight v. United States case in the 1890s, and one of them that was missing was Havemeyer, right? So if you lack the information about Havemeyer's true sort of holdings and ownership, you can't identify the fact that he's actually taken control of 98% of the sugar refining in the industry nationwide, even if you might suspect it. So there were some obvious critical holes in this that would have made it super clear that this was, in fact, a almost total monopoly. Now, as Rachel said, there was ongoing sort of rises and falls in the amount of competition that was happening, and various guys would enter or leave the market at various points. And so it wasn't the case really ever that Havemeyer and American Sugar ever had total control of the market. But even in the cases where there was officially still some viable competition happening, and as Rachel said, unlike in the case of dealing with Standard Oil, you didn't have companies going completely bust because they refused to join in the trust. You still had companies that could viably operate because this was such a lucrative and profitable industry, which also speaks to the idea that there wasn't any sort of overproduction happening, and that there wasn't a sort of, you know, Lyft or Uber style practice of intentionally undercutting all of your competitors with, you know, by going into enormous debt until they leave the market and then jacking up the price. That's not really a thing that ever happened. But in this case, we see kind of the, you know, that when there was this official competition of these companies happening, in many cases, they were also colluding and doing various sort of corrupt practices and cartels that were never officially recognized through ownership mechanisms, even if the U.S. government had been able to get all the information on the actual ownership. This leads us, though, to the second round of litigation that happened. So eventually, a lot more of this information did come out, and it became clearer, especially with the newer antitrust legislations passed under and implemented under people like Teddy Roosevelt and his administration and the Taft administration and so forth. And we've talked previously on our episode about Attorney General Charles Joseph Bonaparte and how many different cases that he launched, you know, or picked up on from his predecessor, you know, breaking up the tobacco industry and things like that. And so one of the 1910 lawsuits that was launched, which then kind of got put on pause a little bit with that wartime unusual food regulation that Rachel alluded to earlier in the late 1910s. Eventually, that is resolved after World War I in the early 1920s, which, of course, is one reason that we're talking about it this year in 1921. And then a year from now, it will be the centennial of the official decree saying that the breakup has been accomplished in May of 1922. So eventually the outcome of this case between the U.S. government and American Sugar, pending from 1910 until it was terminated in 1922, was resolved by the American Sugar, or sometimes known as Domino Sugar, depending on, the period of the company that we're talking about and its various the brand names that it was using and so forth. They agreed to announce that they had reduced their effective control of refined sugar in the United States from 72% to 24% of the industry, which is obviously still a significant player, but much reduced. And I think it's worth underscoring here that 72% is already much reduced from 98%, which is the point that I was making earlier, which is that although they had a near monopoly, they never actually achieved an official monopoly of 100%. And there were definitely new companies entering the market very viably, even if there was some unofficial collusion happening. They were viably able to enter the market and participate, which is why it's down to 72% by the end of this litigation, right before it fell all the way to 24% as part of the agreement not to completely break up the company. The consent decree stipulated that significant divestments of stock holdings by American or Domino had occurred, and the company agreed that they would no longer be controlling the decisions of the major companies from which they had divested or attempting to collude with them. The other companies also could not do the same to each other or to Americans. So you couldn't have a situation where one of the companies that they had officially divested their controlling interest from then turned around and took over American and reformed the trust under, a different company name. Now, according to the Encyclopedia of New York City, the struggle ended with the settlement in 1922 that allowed the firm to remain intact, but forced it to refrain from unfair business practices, and as competition revived, the firm ceased to dominate the industry. And again, here, important to make this distinction, right, is that in some cases, they had taken over companies directly. In some cases, Havemeyer had taken over companies directly or taken at least a controlling interest. And in some cases, the trust just had a controlling interest in these companies rather than owning them outright as subsidiaries. So the core nucleus of the trust was allowed to remain intact, but they did have to divest themselves from their controlling interests and board control and things like that of a bunch of these companies, not necessarily the really small ones, which had generally been long since absorbed, but some of the bigger ones that they were kind of puppeting in other regions of the country. This brings us to an important question, which there seems to be some debate about in a lot of the literature and readings that we did, which is about this monopoly sort of tendency. Now, obviously, for certain industries, as we've talked about on this show, there is a natural monopoly, right? A telephone company would be an example of something that, yes, we currently have various competition, but naturally you tend toward having one company in the space because there's a huge amount of infrastructure that has to be laid down. It often has to be laid over public lands and so forth. You don't want to have to lay two of those. So you tend to say, okay, we will agree that you will have a regulated monopoly of this one area. And there are certain commodities where this is maybe perhaps true as well. But then we get into a more gray area here, with something like refined sugar, which is not the idea that, oh, it's obvious that there should only be one company, but rather that, as happened many times over the course of the Second Industrial Revolution with many industries, and of course is a feature of a lot of literature from people like Marx and Engels, as well as various American thinkers inspired by Marxian economics, is the idea that there's just naturally going to be a tendency to consolidate down toward one company, even if it's not inherently the type of industry that lends itself to being one company because of the specific nature of its business. And again, that gets back to the point of the academic paper that we read from earlier, which is that unlike some of the stuff that we see today where you get the VC firms funding some company to disrupt the industry by basically going into massive debt to undercut all of its peer competitors until there's only one company left, and then you pretend you're going to somehow be able to pay back that debt later, which is obviously not true. In this case, we have a great classic example of an industry that is tending toward consolidation, because the more you consolidate, the more power you have to be able to outcompete, not through price wars necessarily and that kind of thing, but just being able to get higher repayment to your shareholders, a faster adoption of new technologies, any of these type of things, you know, or even just as we talked about with railroad shipping stuff, even if you're not getting some special sort of unique sweetheart deal that only applies to your company and helps you destroy all of your peer competition, just the fact that in many cases, a big shipper, you know, might have gotten a deal for the volume that they're shipping, right? You say, if you ship X amount of pounds or tons of goods on our railroad, as a minimum, we'll cut you a special deal because you're such a big, important customer of ours. And, you know, that deal might be available to any company, but if there's only one or two companies that are able to take advantage of that deal, they're going to have an edge, and that edge is gradually going to add up. Again, in this case, as Rachel said, most of the evidence indicates that people who got bought out by the trust were quite well compensated and made out like bandits in most cases, because this was a hugely lucrative industry. And the people who chose not to sell out also were not destroyed and remained viable players in the business and continued to make money off of it and so forth. But broadly speaking, there were certain advantages that were to be found by consolidating into fewer and fewer companies. Every time the companies consolidated, they could invest in bigger, newer, better equipment. And in fact, they were, you know, contrary to the point of having an overproduction capacity, you know, an excess capacity, which was definitely a challenge with something like the oil industry, where you had literally too many refineries for the amount of oil that was being pumped. In this case, you had just a situation where anytime that they consolidated, that was actually an opportunity to increase the production at a particular site and to increase the technological capacity at a particular site. And there were just inherent efficiencies of economies of scale to consolidate those down to fewer and fewer factory locations and so forth. And you could get more out of each worker with the better equipment and things like that. So it naturally tended to go in that direction. Now, as I was thinking about this episode, I was thinking that sugar does seem to be like, you would think, oh, this is going to be one of those things like salt or something like that, that in the sort of pre-colonial period in Europe, that there was some sort of crown monopoly on. I was not so far able to find a whole ton of evidence to support that idea. Maybe there were certain countries where you would say, oh, this is our preferred merchant who has the import monopoly on either raw sugar or refined sugar. And, you know, there were certainly merchants of certain cities who had a particular edge or advantage in this trade, Venice and Antwerp in particular, Venice importing them from places like Egypt or India, from that part of the Mediterranean, and Antwerp tending to do, especially after they started production of sugarcane in the Canary Islands and in the Azores, moving it from those Atlantic islands to the target markets in Europe. But in general, it did not seem like this was one of the ones that had been long considered to be some sort of, you know, crown privilege monopoly. That being said, of course, as I'm sure people know, you have all sorts of colonial attempts to restrict sugar trade between the colonies of the rival empires. For example, there was a huge amount of smuggling that happened of sugar produced in the Dutch Caribbean colonies to the British American colonies. And that, you know, those industries would have definitely collapsed if it were not for the amount of sugar that they were able to import illegally from these other empires. And that gets into things like the colonial molasses trade, which was then regulated with the Molasses Act of 1733, the Sugar Act of 1764, that one in particular being a contributing factor to the resentment and organization of an American independence movement that subsequently led to the American Revolution. But again, those are sort of mercantilist monopolies, not necessarily the idea of like a natural modern monopoly that we would think of. That being said, if you look today around the world, places like Indonesia, Malaysia, and so forth, either they currently have sugar monopolies where there's a one state monopoly or state regulated monopoly, or they did in the recent past, you know, in the last 30 years or so, they still had one. And that along with the sort of stuff which is beyond the scope of this week's episode to talk about, that present-day web of very complicated governmental subsidies and tariffs around the world for sugar. It's definitely not a free market industry. I would speculate here that that's probably because of the high cost of labor in the production side of sugar, raw sugar cane, if you do not have the option of brutal slavery at your disposal. If you try to have any sort of reasonable labor conditions, it's going to be very expensive. And so I think that is one reason among some others why there's so much subsidizing, tariffs, that kind of thing, and a tendency inherently to go toward a state monopoly on this type of thing. But again, we see from this private monopolization during the Second Industrial Revolution in the United States that there's also just a tendency through natural sort of capitalist processes that aren't particularly nefarious to move in that direction, which again should raise some questions as to what our objectives are with antitrust litigation and so forth. Is the real solution here to break up a bunch of companies and say, okay, now we have a bunch of companies that provide sugar at competitive prices, you know, rather than just having one company do it and say, this is the official price that has been set by the government or whatever. You're already doing all kinds of subsidies and tariffs. Maybe there's a better way of doing that. And I'm not sure that it's obvious to me from doing this research that breaking up a monopoly on this, even though it's a basic consumer good. I mean, you're still, at the end of the day, there's not much difference between table sugar from company A and table sugar from company B. So the idea that you need to have some sort of competition or that they're going to have some breakthrough in new sugar technology seems a little far-fetched to me. And that, in a way, does lend itself to the idea of just saying, well, maybe this is a natural monopoly. At the very least, it has a tendency toward monopoly. Let's talk about the Havemeyer specifically now. Rachel, you alluded to H.O. Havemeyer as being the sugar king. There were other people who were also called the sugar king, and that's consistent with our previous episodes on the asphalt king and the ice king and so forth, and there were various people that had those monikers as well. The Havemeyers, the other sort of advantage that he had, similar to the Rockefellers, was this large extended family of people who could buy up various companies and put them under unofficial control of one family rather than ever officially consolidating them on paper. But the Havemeyers were a bit eccentric, I guess, to put it politely, in addition to being just astronomically wealthy from the refined sugar profits that they were making. Rachel, could you talk to us a little bit about H.O. Havemeyer beyond what you've already told us in terms of his domineering personality?
Yeah, he kind of got a start early as kind of a domineering bully. He ended his formal schooling at age 8 after having gotten a fight with the principal of his school. So even from a very young age, he was kind of that domineering personality. And then from then on, he was involved in his family's sugar refining business. So he kind of came from a long line. His grandfather started a sugar company, and they were involved with the Elder family. So the Elders and the Havemeyers were kind of these pillars of the sugar industry in New York. And he actually apprenticed with the Elder family when he was 15, and he kind of learned the ins and outs of the sugar business at that time. And not only did he apprentice with the Elder family, he actually married into the Elder family. He was married to Louise Elder, and kind of this is kind of a complicated family tree. Louise Elder was the sister of his older sister's husband, and it was part of the Elder family that took him into business and helped raise him. He was married to Louise Elder for 12 years until they divorced. And the year after they divorced, he married 28-year-old Louisine Elder, who was actually Louise Elder's niece. So this was coming from his Wikipedia article and also an article on brooklynpaper.com. The union of H.O. and Louisine took place in the context of an inbred family situation typical of the American WASP elite. The Elders and the Havemeyers were New York sugar families that performed a complicated merger both at the altar and in the boardroom. From age 15, H.O. was raised by Louisine's parents and later married Louisine's aunt. H.O.'s older sister married Louisine's uncle. Finally, in 1883, H.O. divorced his first wife and married her much younger niece, Louisine. The article says much younger, but she was 28 at the time. She was a fully formed adult. So I don't think there was any nefarious age difference discourse happening at that time. Another thing is, one of the attorneys who helped Havemeyer reorganize the Sugar Trust in 1891 was Elihu Root, who was the future U.S. Secretary of War and Secretary of State, also a future U.S. Senator for New York, who at the time had recently been the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York with jurisdiction over Wall Street. So he definitely had a lot of New York elite ties and contacts who kind of helped him in his business practices. So as we talked about earlier, he kind of had a war with Spreckles, but later they joined sides. Another person he got into a war with was John Arbuckle. John Arbuckle had innovated a better way of packaging coffee beans, and he wanted to translate that into packaging sugar. So initially he bought sugar from American Sugar Refining, and later he kind of tried to go into the refining business himself. Havemeyer retaliated by buying shares in a coffee company, and then he started undercutting Arbuckle's prices. So then Arbuckle cut his sugar prices. They both sustained pretty heavy losses and loss of profits for 3 years until they finally came to an agreement in 1901. So that kind of also goes into his domineering personality. So even though he kind of used the price wars as a last resort, he didn't really shy away from using them when he felt wronged, which he did. He felt wronged by John Arbuckle for sure. So this price war with Arbuckle weakened more of Havemeyer's competitors, and then he was able to pick up three more independent firms. These got consolidated into the National Sugar Refining Company of New Jersey, and they kind of operated separately from the Sugar Trust. However, Havemeyer owned 50% of their stock, and National did receive preferential treatment from the trust. He also expanded west into the sugar beet factory, or the sugar beet industry in the west in 1902. We kind of talked about that earlier. He acquired Amalgamated Sugar Company and the Great Western Sugar Company. He also became the largest shareholder of the LDS Church operated Utah, Idaho Sugar Company. So he kind of had his fingers in all of the pies, whether it was sugar cane refining or sugar beet refining. He also expanded south into Cuba in 1906 and formed the Cuban American Sugar Company. On a personal note, he was an avid collector of art and musical instruments. Mary Cassatt, the Impressionist artist, was a big influence on the Havemeyer's art collection. Mary Cassatt met Louisine Havemeyer in Paris and kind of encouraged her to acquire Impressionist artists. They had a huge collection of Degas, Manet, Monet, Pizarro, and as well as other artists. Havemeyer also engaged in philanthropy like his fellow industrialists at the time. It was kind of that robber baron, noblesse oblige, that was kind of happening at that time. He was a trustee of the American Museum of Natural History, and he and his brothers paid for Havemeyer Hall for a school of mines at Columbia University, where their father studied. He also paid for a school for Greenwich, Connecticut, where he built one of his homes. As I mentioned earlier, throughout the first two decades of the 20th century, the Havemeyers assembled an astonishing art collection, pursuing European treasures with the same aggressiveness that he employed in swallowing up business competitors. H.O. became furious when the Italian government prevented him from exporting Botticelli's Birth of Venus. Nevertheless, besides numerous Degas, the pair was able to buy hundreds, if not thousands, of works by Veronese, Rubens, Rembrandt, El Greco, Goya, Corot, Cezanne, Renoir, Monet, and Manet. He died fairly young. He died of acute indigestion December 4th, 1907, 5 days after being stricken on Thanksgiving, which sounds like a pretty terrible way to die, just digestive failure and dying over 5 days of suffering. It sounds like Louisine Havemeyer was also a pretty big personality. She kind of came into her own after H.O.'s death, became a more prominent public figure. She also was really involved in art collection. Both Louisine and H.O. had to approve of a piece of art before they added it to their collection. So they had equal say in the accumulation of their art. Louisine was also involved in the suffrage movement. After H.O.'s death, she used the art collection, which she lent out to galleries to exhibit, to financially back suffragist Alice Paul, who agitated for women's suffrage, and she was a pretty out there character. Alice Paul caused a riot before Wilson's first inauguration. She also led pickets of the White House during World War I. They were both often arrested on the wrong side of the law during this time. Havemeyer attempted to burn an effigy of President Wilson in 1919, which did draw national attention. She was fined $5 for this crime, but she refused to pay and actually spent 3 days in jail. When she died at 73 in 1929, she left more than 1,000 paintings and sculptures to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. The Havemeyer collection remains the biggest single part of the Met. Unlike most benefactors, however, Louisine gave her gift with no requirements that her name be attached or that the works be exhibited in a certain way. Louisine Havemeyer's second daughter, Electra, married a Vanderbilt grandson and became in her own right an eccentric collector of Americana, eventually establishing the Shelburne Museum in Vermont, which has a huge collection of Americana and art. It's kind of a common story, but the elite are kind of allowed to be eccentric, allowed to do kind of wild and crazy things. The Havemeyers were definitely no exception. They were very eccentric people, very outre, very bold. And they also contributed a lot to the art world.
And Kelly and I have both been to the Shelburne Museum in Vermont. We do recommend that. But we are going to talk now, return to the sugar at hand and talk a little bit about some of the material history and industrial processes. Again, to emphasize, we are mostly talking today about the refinery side of the sugar industry rather than the production side, although we're about to talk a little bit about the production side. As Rachel just alluded to a few minutes ago, people like Havemeyer and certainly Spreckels did have some sort of vertical integration involvement in the sugar production side of the industry as well, especially Havemeyer branching out after Cuba was taken into U.S. custody, at least temporarily, as part of the aftermath of the Spanish-American War. And so there were certain steps in that direction of vertical integration rather than just horizontally integrating all of the refinery companies. But let's get into some of the material history and industrial processes. So one of the earlier technologies, in fact, of the Industrial Revolution in the mid to late 18th century and the very early 19th century was figuring out how to mechanize sugar production. Much like the cotton gin, which we covered recently on episode 358 and talking about the implications of that, while the industrial mechanization might have allowed sugar plantations to reduce their reliance on horrifically brutal forced labor by slaves, instead it merely allowed early adopters in agri-capitalism to extract more profits per worker. Obviously, sugar was an integral part of the transatlantic triangle trade, as we've alluded to several times before, and that was happening since the start of the 1500s. And that, again, to reemphasize, relied heavily on some of the most intolerable slave conditions in the world. And unfortunately, that continued in various countries, and this included, in the end, finally, the last official one, Cuba, as late as the 1880s, almost to the period we're talking about here today. And that was over two decades after even the United States had abolished slavery. Cuba's sugar elite was noted for its enthusiastic adoption of new sugar technologies to get more profit out of its slave workforce. They also benefited as the other countries one by one abolished slavery, either voluntarily or through revolutions and civil wars. But critically, it must be emphasized that after the abolition of slavery in the various sugar-producing countries in the world, slave labor on sugar plantations was generally immediately replaced by harsh indentured servitude that probably only barely qualifies as not being slavery, and also assumes a level of genuine understanding of contracts that many workers, especially colonized or subjugated populations, probably lacked when they signed those contracts, right? If you were someone that was being sort of dragooned into service from Australia or New Zealand or Southeast Asia or whatever, and you were being put to work on a plantation in Southeast Asia or a plantation on one of the Pacific Islands, like the Hawaiian Islands, you were probably not particularly free by any sort of definition that we would understand as being genuinely free. And your working conditions were probably not a whole lot better than sort of the height of brutal chattel slavery on these sugar plantations. Kelly, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about some of the changes in technology on the refining side over time as well. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. The sugar refining process was largely the same from the 14th century to the mid-19th century. Sugar was converted from the cane product to cane juice near the sugar cane field within 24 hours of harvesting. And then this cane juice is what would get sent to the refineries, where they converted it into loaves, not sort of the yellow domino granulated sugar we imagine today, but loaves of compact sugar. And this would be at the corner store. You would go to the corner store, ask for some sugar, and they would cut off a corner of the loaf with what they called sugar nippers. And then you would take home this like block of sugar, go home and probably like pound it yourself with a hammer or similar instrument to get a product that was actually usable. But in 1853, the Boston Sugar Company pioneered granulated sugar, which is the sugar we think of today. And by 1873, sugar refineries everywhere were using this technology, and they were using these large centrifuges to dry out the sugar and create the granulated sugar. When Boston Sugar Company first began producing granulated sugar, they had somebody basically like raking the sugar at all times while it was drying so that it didn't clump together. But they realized large centrifugal machines could do the same thing, which made this granulated sugar in mass quantities possible. And then after 1873, the next innovation came in the 1890s as companies moved from selling granulated sugar in like large barrels that you would then go to the store and scoop out to individually packaged sugar, similar to the way that we buy it today.
And that critically is where that guy Arbuckle, not the guy from Garfield, but anyway, the guy Arbuckle came into the story earlier, as Rachel was describing. He was from the coffee industry, which was already very much in the space of having prepackaged amounts of coffee beans. But of course, coffee beans don't stick together in the way that sugar does. And he had figured out, okay, I think I have a way of prepackaging set amounts of sugar rather than having people go to the corner store and scoop it out of a barrel. And when he was purchasing this refined sugar from the sugar trust, he got into a dispute with them and decided, well, screw that. I'm going to start my own sugar company or sugar refining company so that I can just package it up myself and not have to buy it from a third party. And this also led Havemeyer to go into the coffee business to get back at him for that. Now, we're nearing the end of our narrative here. Again, there's so many different things we could talk about, but let's talk a little bit more about some of the geopolitics here, especially as it relates to the configuration of the United States today. So trade wars between Spain and the U.S. in the decades leading up to the Spanish-American War of 1898 severely hurt the Puerto Rican sugar plantations. We've talked a lot on this episode about the Cuban sugar plantations, but not so much about the Puerto Rican ones. And Cuba is no longer part of the United States' official sphere of control, and Puerto Rico is part of the United States, but not a state. The acquisition of Puerto Rico after the war put it in a similar position to the recently seized Hawaiian Islands, which themselves had been seized by sugar plantation elites and brought into the U.S. sphere of control. And Puerto Rico was then treated as an internal producer rather than a foreign producer of raw sugarcane. So after the Spanish-American War, American investors pounced on the opportunity and poured capital into reviving the sugarcane plantations of Puerto Rico. But eventually that sort of wound down, and many of the sugar workers from the plantations moved to the mainland in places like New York City after those plantations started to close down as the mid-20th century approached, which is how you end up with a large population of Puerto Rican workers in a different part of the sugar industry, centered in places like New York. And today, one of the big refineries that used to belong to the Sugar Trust, by today, I mean the recent past of the past several years, got torn down and replaced with luxury apartments or office space or something like that. And it's just a kind of an interesting legacy. Kelly, I know you wanted to talk a little bit before we wrap up about kind of just the impact that this industry had, kind of like the fruit industry, on so many of these tropical countries that, you know, either lost their independence or were essentially destroyed in trying to maintain their independence as a result of this very lucrative industry.
Yeah, absolutely. Puerto Rico and Hawaii are the most sort of obvious ones because they became colonies of the United States and were sort of were very helpful to these sugar refineries in the continental United States because sugar could be imported from an, sort of an internal source, if you will. And like you mentioned, that is still very present today. It was just 2004 that the Domino sugar factory closed down in Brooklyn, New York. And so you still have, you know, obviously a very large Puerto Rican population in New York, some of that stemming from the sugar industry. And we won't have time to, of course, touch on all of it today, but it wasn't just Puerto Rico and Hawaii. It was Haiti, the Philippines, anywhere where they folks could grow sugar. They did grow sugar, and businessmen in the government of the United States went there and pretty mercilessly, as so often happens, sort of just like pillaged these countries for their natural resources and their ability to grow sugar. There are very few places in the continental United States that are friendly for sugar growing, and the demand for sugar in the United States has just grown exponentially since it was first introduced. And so that sugar comes from somewhere, and it mostly came from warm tropical islands where people were really abused and in many ways enslaved in order to produce sugar for the United States.
Rachel, did you want to talk about any of the stuff that we've talked about today, reflect on any of this? I know that I had also earlier talked at some length about sort of the monopolization of this industry and what, you know, maybe the implications of that were. But I didn't really like stop to check in with either of you about your sort of thoughts on that.
Well, I do have a personal connection. The sugar beet industry is still going on pretty strongly in the West. And I actually grew up next to a sugar beet refinery. And as some of you may know, I don't know how close you are to industrial factories or other works, but refining sugar beets is a very stinky process. It smells similar to like peanut butter and poop. I don't know. It's like an odd mixture. And you can always tell when the sugar beet factory is kind of firing up because the stench kind of spreads through the whole city of Nampa, which is a suburb of Boise, about 20, 25 minutes away from Boise. And the headquarters of the Amalgamated Sugar Factory, which still exists today, is headquartered in Boise. So there's definitely a modern local tie-in to the sugary industry as part of the larger sugar refining industry.
Any other concluding thoughts from either of you about any of the stuff that we've talked about today?
Like you said, it's not a free market industry at all. And the kind of the subsidization and tariff of both raw and refined sugar has had the unintended consequence of making high fructose corn syrup so prevalent in the U.S. today as kind of a cane sugar substitute. And it's definitely kind of led to just a reimagining of the food industry that I don't think Havemeyer could have possibly foreseen.
Yeah, I was similarly thinking just about the high fructose corn syrup that many food manufacturers began to use because the price of sugar was artificially high thanks to interference by the government. And so, I mean, when we talk about all, you know, diabetes and childhood obesity and all those health problems plaguing our country today, that those can be traced to many places, but certainly the Habermeyer family is one of those sources of making sugar, and then high fructose corn syrup, such an essential part of the American diet.
Well, Kelly, thank you for coming on this week to help us research and talk about one of these other commodity monopolizations, the sugar trust of the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
Thank you for having me.
And Rachel, thank you for all of your work on this episode as well.
Always a pleasure, Bill.